I'm at Colin Wagner's house. It's his 105th birthday. I feel so delighted to be welcomed in today. Thank you so much for having me here with you on such a special day, Colin.
It's a pleasure to see you.
Yes, you too. And very exciting day. The Premier's sent you flowers. You've received a card from the Prime Minister. Yeah. Must have been a wonderful morning so far.
Yes, I have a nice lot of cards out there on the table. When I reached 100, I thought that'd be it. I've just gone up year after year after year. I think I'm deteriorating very slowly.
Mm.
I hope so.
Oh, that's absolutely brilliant. Do you have anything that you could attribute your health and success to, do you think?
No, I've been asked that before. The last person who asked me that, I said, if there's any vitamin company that would care to sponsor me.
Yes, start spruiking them.
I'll be in it.
And, you know, driving around on motorbikes and in fast cars, that maybe has been a benefit to your life. You enjoy a good motor car?
Yes. In the Great Depression, motor cars were hard to get. And sports cars, for kids like me, were impossible to get. So the best thing I could do is to go and make one.
You made one?
I made one out of bits and pieces with a lot of help from professionals.
Wow.
I made it look like an MG. I used that for a while. Then I sold that. And I bought a Vauxhall Sports Roadster. That had a flat-out speed of 74 mile an hour. I knew that because then the valves are set to bounce at that. That kept me going right through the war. It was up on blocks, of course, for about 6 years. It had gone up in value since the war because cars were hard to get. So.
Did you teach yourself? Was there a mentor or someone to teach you how to build that car?
No, but my father was an engineer.
Ah, that would help.
Oh, I had a flying start there.
I hear your parents gave you a motorbike when you were 16.
Yeah. I think it was to get rid of me, but it didn't.
It didn't work. Is it 1 in 10 people had a motor car at that time?
Yeah, they reckon 1 in 10 people had a motor car. But when I had the motorbike, very, very few kids had a motorbike. But the other chap I met with a motorbike was about the same age as me. His name is Frank Tuck. And we used to ride on the goat tracks at the back of Adelaide Zoo, the Torrens. And he was always better than me. And I thought, well, I'm only a second-rate rider. But I stopped riding motorbikes and went to motor cars. But he kept on motorbikes and he became famous. And today there's Atjajara Motorbike Club still have a rally, and it's named after Frank Tuck.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
he was killed, of course, eventually, but he became quite famous, and I didn't.
Well, you're famous now, and you got to tick something off your bucket list a few years ago, going around the bend. Yeah. That would have been good fun.
You know about that.
I do.
We'll get to that one.
And you're still driving. You're the oldest South Australian with a driver's licence, I hear.
They're checking on the newspaper now. They've got all the states. We've just heard from this morning. There's somebody in New South Wales that's very close to me, and they're checking up to see. And if
who wins if, the competition?
Competition. But somebody, the Courier newspaper's doing that one. So if they do, they'll probably run an article on it.
All right. Yeah. Oh, I look forward to seeing that. Yeah. What's your favourite classic car from over the years that you've had?
Had to be a Ferrari. I have a Jensen Interceptor now. And I see one of the newspaper things. They're interviewing somebody. And the cars he had. They said, what sort of a car would you like to have? He said, a Jensen Interceptor Series 3.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I've got.
Beautiful.
So I was invited up to the raceway.
The Bend Motorsport Park?
Yes. Had the track car there to show me the way around, the two-track car. So I just followed him. And he knew that I had a car that was go fast.
Oh, yeah.
So all my life I wanted to find out how fast this car would go because 50 years ago it would do 230 kilometres an hour. And I went on the straight, they timed me at 222.
Oh.
So I come back and I found a little crack in the carburetor. So I replaced the carburetor. And the only place I could get the carburetor from was called the Outlaw Speed Shop.
Oh, right. Outlaw.
Rather amusing. So I'd like to go out there again to see if I can pick up that 8 kilometres an hour that I...
Yeah.
I'm doing 230.
That's wonderful. That's on my bucket list too, to go and drive very fast at the bend. That'd be great.
Oh, right. Yes. You want to do it too?
I'd love to, yeah.
There's a lovely straight. Otherwise, to me, it's a... the course is very tight.
Yes. That's the tricky bit, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's a sharp corner before you come onto the straight. You know, the wheel's virtually locked on that one. I can let him go and get around.
Yeah.
He had a Mustang. So I'll keep up with you if I can. But he slowly got away from me.
Ah.
The engine in the Jensen is a Chrysler, a 7.2 litre.
Right. Oh, 7.2 litres.
Yeah.
Wow.
I called the 440. And they're the ones that they use in the American cars, the Dodge Dart and that.
Yes.
You know, the top of the range, they fetch millions of them.
Yeah. They love their big cars over there.
So they class the Jensen as a Chrysler in a silk suit.
Right.
Because the body's made in England.
Wow. Now, going back to that time when you were a teen and you got the motorbike, it wasn't long after that that you got involved in the war, is that right?
Yes, there's four of us got together. One of my friends, was the son of a chap who used to race motor cars, of course. It'd be natural. and it was because we had motor cars. And very few of us had motor cars.
Ah.
And the four of us joined the army together. We joined it before the war.
Mm.
We thought we'd join it before they come and get us.
So you want...
And so... Really, went in the war from 1939, and it started in 1939.
Right. And was that a patriotic desire, or...?
No.
No?
Nothing.
Nah.
Certainly not patriotic. Probably, I think more likely that we went to them before they came to us.
Right. What intrigued you about joining up?
Yes, because I could pick the unit I wanted.
Right.
If I was called up, I'd have to go where they wanted to go. But I picked the signals because I was interested in radio. I want that to be my living. At 14 years of age, I was making 7-valve super heterodyne radios.
Oh, right.
So, you know, right up with it.
So you're just obviously intrigued about how things work. Is that right?
Well, I was doing a course in radio, and then there came the Depression, and I had a friend about a year ahead of me. He had a contract to make radios. And with his bicycle, he'd go into Runnell Street, pick up the bits to make a 5-valve radio, come back home to Fullerton, and he'd spend all day making that radio. The next morning he'd take that radio back, and then he'd get another bits and tape. And for the whole day's work, he'd get 6 shillings.
What would six shillings buy you? 60 cents.
I lost interest.
Yeah.
I hadn't lost it, though. When the war came, we had a new type of radio that came in.
Mm.
You know, it was real out of this world. We call the 101 sets. They had a radio and a transmitter together. They had a range of 25 miles. With Darwin, they had a line link. It was a single line going all the way over to Queensland. Nothing else in between. So I thought, we've got to put in a radio link. The only radios they could find were the 101 sets, a range of 25 miles. They put one in Darwin and one in Alice Springs. They got two chaps who knew what to do, and they got through to one another. But they couldn't get through to Adelaide. So they said to me, go to Loveday, where there's going to be a POW camp. I was there before that.
And that's in the Riverland?
That'd be 1940.
Yep.
Beforehand, probably started. And they said, see, put up with the 101 set, put up a halfway burial and see if you can get Alice Springs.
Mm.
So I did, I got Alice Springs. I put another burial and I got Adelaide.
Wow, so you helped connect people so they could communicate.
I was in between link.
Wow.
So that went on several months. And then the war got serious and I was called smartly back to Adelaide. I must have got back early in the morning, about 8 o'clock. And I said, can I have some leave? And they said, well, you can have leave till 12 o'clock. That gave me 4 hours. And I had my girlfriend, who lived nearby, and I raced around the place. I said, let's go and get married.
Oh, quick, let's get married before I have to go overseas.
So we went in the registry office.
Wow.
Got married, and I was back at camp at 12 o'clock.
Oh, dear, not the wedding that you might have been envisaging.
It was quite a cheap one. It cost me, I always told her she cost me 15 shillings.
But she was the woman who you spent many, many years with, yeah, and had children, yeah, with.
Because she died.
Oh.
Short of 50 or 60 years. I mean.
Wow. Mm. And what was Peggy like?
Oh, very good, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, she kept me along with it all. And some of her painting up there on the wall.
Oh, they're her paintings, are they? Did, yeah, she was an artist?
Oh, they're the, not painting, the tapestry sort of,
oh,
thing.
Oh, beautiful.
She got some paintings out there. That, they're all her work.
Very creative woman.
I can show you a photo of her.
Mm. It must have been tough having to leave her at that point, straight after getting married. And you went to...
No, I was more excited getting married.
You must have missed her when you were over there, though.
Yeah, yeah. And you got to put up the army then.
Yes.
Oh, yes. The reason that I was sent to Bone Giller,
mm,
because they'd called up thousands and thousands of 18-year-olds, but they had no one to instruct them.
Oh.
And all that stuff that I'd been learning, and I gave up because there's no money in it,
yeah,
that then came into it, and I was fully qualified as an instructor.
But you had never taught before?
No. I said to them, they said, from now on, you're an instructor. And I said, I don't think about instructing. They said, you've got 3 stripes, go out and earn them.
Wow.
And that, well, then they had to find me a job, you know, some a sergeant's place in a unit.
Mm.
And they found it for me, an army signal unit. And from there I went to training. We went up to Moratai, and then we saw LSTs coming in. The doors opened at the front. We knew they were for us. I went up to the 9th Division. We loaded them, and I had cameras, and I took photographs all the way along. And there's one photograph of myself and our 4 drivers. And I said to the chap, why'd you take that after? He said, well, you're doing a beach landing and explosions in case you didn't make it.
Oh, wow.
We all did.
Oh, no.
And there's even a photograph of me going in from, yeah, the LSD again. We didn't know how deep the water would be. We didn't know. There's a lot of ifs and buts, but it all worked out all right.
Oh, my goodness. That just reminded me you must have been so close to death. And just that, you know, having mates die.
No,
and...
we're more excited.
Oh.
That's the least of our worries.
Did you feel invincible?
Probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
When the Japanese surrendered, we found out about the death marches, and there was a garrison at Sandakan that was left there after they'd all marched out. And it was our job to pick them up. And it was a corporal from our unit, Corporal McDougall, who was chosen to go on an LST, only about 20 of us, to go around and pick up the garrison that was there. Before he left, I gave him my gun. It was a submachine gun. It was better than his. This is his story. When they got around to Sandakan to pick up the garrison, they're all waiting at the wharf. We knew then that they had a radio and they were kept informed. And that radio was brought back to our quarters. Message came down from higher up. That particular radio had to go back to Australia. So in the Australian War Memorial, there's a Japanese radio. I don't know what's on it, but that was the one that we used to send Duncan. The corporal, he went through the troops looking for the highest ranking officer he could find. He found him sitting in a tent and half a dozen wooden boxes. The corporal pointed my machine gun at him and told him to get out and join the others. We didn't find out till afterwards that he was a colonel and was the one directly responsible for the death marches.
Wow.
I have several photos of a group of soldiers and he was one of them. He was eventually tried and hung. Then they were put on the boat. It was an iron ship. They were put down deck. It was a hot day. It was a hot ship, and they were put down below. It was very hot. On the way back, they were put in charge of a private for a couple of hours, and he had other ideas. The corporal came back to our unit in a jeep with a big smile on his face and all the wooden boxes. And the wooden boxes were marked Yokohama Species Bank. They were full of money.
Mm.
And we thought we're going to fill our pockets with this stuff. Japanese invasion money. And to cap it all off, I was a bunny that was given the job of burning it because orders came through that money had to be burnt so it wouldn't get in the wrong hands. That boys put a pile of the money in front of me. We all helped ourselves. And I went out and got a bucket of petrol and threw it on it and put a match to it. And all the others came out and left me. I was there on my own with about $1 million worth of money in front of me.
Oh, my goodness.
The money was packed tight like phone books. And I packed it with a stick all that day and it smoldered all that night. And I finished off the next morning and it was just a small heap of red air.
Wow.
That was it. So in other words, I'd burnt all the money from Yokohama Species Bank.
There you go.
They were eventually taken over by the Bank of Japan. Mm. But I like to think I made them solvent.
Mm. That's an extraordinary contribution.
I burnt a lot of money.
Wow. Where were you when the war ended?
In Borneo.
You're in Borneo.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Troop coming back.
Tell me about that time, when it ended.
We were waiting for the on the looking horizon for a ship to come in. And there was no ship coming in. But after about a month, we heard that Gracie Fields, the world-famous stage and screen entertainer, was coming in to put on a concert for us. I went over to look at the concert area. Somebody rigged up a stage. And somebody was finding chairs and putting them right in front of the stage. I spoke to one of the chaps and I said, I thought this was a stand-up concert. And he said, it is. These chairs are the officers only. Oh, bugger that. So I went back to camp and came the time to go to the concert. Everyone was going. I volunteered to stay behind and look after the camp. It was quite strange in the camp. No noise. And I heard a great roar of laughter, like I've never heard before. And I thought I must be missing a good concert. 50 years later, I was back there for a memorial service. And two of our group, Tardy, were stage entertainers. The chap, one of them was famous. He spoke to me and he said, of all his stage career, he'd never heard a better opening line to a concert than the Gracie Fields concert. I knew what he was talking about. He said the compere of the show was a private from Western Australia. He walked out on the stage full of confidence, looked all around him, and then looked down in front of him. And he said, it's easy to see the war's over. All the officers are in the front line. That brought the big roar of laughter.
And you found out quite a few years later.
It took me 50 years to find that one, to find out what the roar of laughter is about.
Right.
We had to wait all the way down to December the 10th, 1945. And I'd walked over to the airstrip, which wasn't far away, with a handful of cigarettes, using my trading bag to get some more camera material. When I heard a plane start up. I heard it roar down the runway, and suddenly the engine stopped, and there was an enormous bang. The plane had crashed on takeoff. We raced out there. There was about half a dozen people on the plane. They're all killed on impact. We couldn't get near the plane, so there wasn't any point in doing it. So I watched the bodies there alongside the plane just be cremated. There's nothing to bury. And as I walked back, I saw two Mustang aeroplanes with the engines knocked out of them. The planes not knocked over, but the engines knocked out of them. The wingtip of that plane had taken those two engines out without knocking the planes over. That was what happened there. And right on that time, a chap from our unit came and said to me, come back straight away, two ships are coming to take us home. I never forget that point. On one side, I had a tragedy, and people in Australia were going to receive some terrible news, and I just received some good news.
Mm.
I went back to the ship. The newspaper said the 1,500 got in each ship. They weren't made to carry any passengers at all. We had nowhere to eat, nowhere to sleep, virtually nothing to eat. The tins of stew followed us on. You'd have cold stew if you wanted it. But that, we didn't care, we were going home. And when we, as our ship was going down the Brisbane River, the war had been over a couple of months. I thought Australia would have forgotten about us. But they hadn't. The Australian 9th Division coming home. The boats we passed at home shot their fire hoses into the air welcoming us. There's a troop train standing by, and the people of Brisbane were standing by too with trucks. They loaded us in the backs of trucks and slowly drove us down the main street of Brisbane to a ticker tape welcome home, or little bits of paper falling down. We were wet from a shower of rain, we were dirty, we were hungry, but we didn't care. We were going home. And the best Christmas present I ever got in my life was 10:30 Christmas morning, 1945, when a train pulled in at Adelaide Railway Station and I was on it. At last I was home. My father picked me up and brought me home. It was a wonderful feeling to walk up to my front door knowing I'd never have to go away again.
Wonderful. I hear that you consider every year, every moment that you have after the war to be a bonus.
Yes, I finish up PSD, post-stress disorder. I take a sleeping tablet and I don't come good until about 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the morning for them to wear off. Now, I knew they were going to wear off before you came.
Oh, thank you. And they
have. I remember 10:30 this morning, I was right.
Yeah.
But that's the only thing. I haven't got all the stresses and disorders. You know, people go to Vietnam for 12 months and they come back with all the problems in the world. I'm going to meet two of them tonight.
Oh, right. Yes, so what's planned for your birthday this evening?
I'll go along to RSL. They're not planning anything for me. The hundreds. We had it here. We had a band and about 100 people.
Wow.
I call it a three-dog party. The reason being that some of the chaps had dogs, you know, comfort dogs.
Oh, yes.
So the three of them came along with dogs. So I had a three-dog party.
Oh, that's lovely. What are you most proud of?
My father took me to Canberra in a 1925 Studebaker. I was not to know it then, but 30 years later, I was to drive to Brisbane in a 1916 Studebaker. So I drove up to Brisbane and back. I was sponsored by Golden Fleece at that stage. Went to Surfers Paradise and everything like it. Motels, 1955, motels had just been introduced into Australia. I stayed at the High Ho Motel, Jack Davies. I think it still exists. And I came back to saw my parents. I said, stop what you're doing. We're going to the motel business. They said, we don't know what a motel is. We just go away, sort of thing. It took me about 12 months to convince them to go to the motel because he had a block of land on the Brisbane Road. Finally convinced him, we put up a motel. We had to put up the first, but I think we probably about the second motel in Adelaide. And after that, they sprang up like mushrooms.
Oh, so that was quite successful for you?
It was a beauty, that one. When it was finished, I had to work out how to do it. I looked at all American magazines, and the best I could find to put up was a big sign about 8 feet roof with motel on it, just big sign. And we put that out the front. Wife and there, we walked out and we thought, well, this motel's finished. So we said, let's turn the lights on and see if it works. So we had to turn it and a big motel sign come up. The people started to come in.
Oh, yes?
We had about 3 people that night. And I said to people, what do we do? You take them. They went to the motel next week before it opened. And then we had somebody, a good manageress, who sort of took over the motel, managed it for us. I went in once a week to leave her. And she had a wonderful time, and so did I.
Have you been ticking off a lot of things on your bucket list in recent years?
No, theoretically I should have done them all by 100. I was chopping wood yesterday.
Oh, that's a good effort.
Yeah. Paul took a photo of me doing it. I do it all mechanically, or I do it pull lever.
Oh, right.
Yeah, not out of the next.
So you're still pretty active, doing things around the house?
I'm 100%.
Mm.
I haven't slowed down. When I, at the, something recently, I was invited along because Edith was there. Edith being a 103-year-old, but she's only in a chair all the time. And they had a cake the other side of the room. And I had to get up and walk. You know, I just walked quite normally over to it and cut the cake and just walked back. Paul said there was an 80-year-old along. He said, I can't even walk like that.
Yeah.
I do my own shopping and nobody does anything for me.
And you're living with your son?
Well, yes, I can't do without him. It's a second life for him too. He's a great help to me.
Well, they do say that that's one of the ways to really stay alive and, you know, vibrant is to be out active and doing things.
You've got to be active. Yeah. And have all your marbles too as a help.
Well, thank you so much for having me in your home today to celebrate your birthday with you.
Yes, okay. Have I covered it all?
I think so.